All right. Welcome back to We Are Joining You from the Live Production Summit. I'm Michael Lawrence from the Signal Noise Podcast. As always, I'm joined by my co-host Chris Leonard and Kyle Trinside. What's going on, fellas?
How's it going?
Howdy.
That we see how we got super formal all of a sudden because we were it was like pretty laid back. It's something about that theme song. You hit that thing.
This kicks it in gear.
Yeah, you just, you know, game face, bro, game face. And then here we are. thanks everybody for joining us. We already have some friendly, familiar names, which is really cool.
I know Kyle.
You know Kyle?
Yeah. You know Chris.
I mean, I've never met him before, but I know him.
That's true. You actually haven't met him before.
I've been in the room more times with Jamie than anyone else on this panel.
So
Chris and I have never met in person.
I've never met Michael.
Chris is actually an elaborate catfish, and because I've never laid eyes on him. So
it's a simulation.
We met through Tinder.
I think I'm an only fan of Kyle. People in this room.
That's true.
It is definitely Friday. All right, moving on. Let's go.
All right. So the name of this panel is How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the SPL Meter. And what we're going to talk about is a little bit different angle on a lot of the stuff that we've had some conversations about on our podcast with this. If you've come to any of the Rational Acoustics training classes, this is something that we've talked about. We're going to take a little different tack on that today. Our guest for this discussion, Jamie Anderson, president of Rational Acoustics.
Yay.
And I believe our most frequent flyer on the podcast, Mr. Ryan John. Yeah, I think you're tied with Yakubuski, actually.
Yeah, and just for clarity, I only became a guest on this about 8 minutes ago.
Yes, because I realized we're talking about mixing, and I was like,
I know who mixes
on the show.
Jamie immediately recuses himself from any dialogue about mixing, so I said we should probably have a mixer on the show. So here we are. What I kind of want to focus on is, you know, I think a lot of people's first reaction when you show up to a venue and there's an SPL speed limit, right? A lot of people are like, it's immediately this kind of red tape that you have to deal with. And for a long time, I had that reaction as well. And we're going to just try to have a dialogue about kind of some alternate ways to view that and getting familiar enough with the tool set to make it useful to you, just like an RTA would be useful to you. I don't know. We'll probably all set up an RTA at front of house when we're mixing, even if we're not required by law to set up an RTA. Right. So kind of in the same vein, you know, let's talk about SPL monitoring, not from a compliance angle because we have to, but what are some things we can do with it because we want to, because it's cool, because it's helpful. I'm going to talk about sort of my path through becoming familiar with the tools and what that allowed me to do in my mixes. And I'll, you know, spoiler alert, it's revolutionized the way that I mix. And it's really allowed me to hit a much higher level of quality and consistency. And I'm much, much happier with the work that I'm doing now. And so we're going to kind of take that angle on it. I guess we're going to start here. And I know, Chris, you do a lot of this work at your church as well. So we can kind of cover a couple angles on that.
Yeah.
I think a good starting point is like, you know, why are you using this tool if you're not being forced to? And a big component of that is this idea of consistency, of quality control. Giving the same show every night, or in the case of like House of Worship, the same service, you're doing three services in a day and they should all be the same for all the reasons that it's nice to have another check on what your ears are telling you, for all the reasons that our perception is not always the most reliable indicator of how loud something is or what the level is, or it was just the same as it was last night, right? You just got off a plane or you've been on the road for a while. So we have all of these reasons that it's a really, really helpful tool set to have in front of you when you're mixing. And so for me, the thing that I think the biggest thing for me has been controlling the dynamic range of the show. And this is where I'm sure Ryan will have some really good thoughts on this. You know, it's all about managing, using loudness as a tool, not as a sledgehammer. And I know that the next song coming up, that's the big hit. We're going to want to kind of really push that one. I'm going to pull back the song before that. Not much, a dB and a half. And you kind of buy yourself up, if you're mixing against an LEQ limit, you're going to buy yourself some leg room, but you also are going to create a situation where that big hit is subjectively louder because it was louder than the thing that just came before it. And so, you know, looking at, I log every rehearsal and I look at those contours and I can see where the high energy songs are and where the ballads are, and sculpting the whole set and it gives it, you have a situation where the loud moments start having real impact and your quiet moments start having real intimacy and being able to kind of nail that down. So that's kind of where I want to start. And I know Ryan's already looks like he's got some thoughts in mind. So go ahead, Ryan, jump in there.
Well, I think Kyle wanted to jump in too.
Yeah, Kyle's raising his hand. That's Kyle.
He was being very formal, Kyle, raising his hand.
You don't have to raise your hand, Kyle. It's your show, buddy.
I'd like for you to talk about the impact of SQL on people too, because you've done a lot of work in that and the reasons behind why we should be paying attention to it.
Sure.
You know, your studies are pretty effective to be able to say, you know, hey, the exposure levels and things that are going down. And especially for us mixing the show or being around loudspeakers, you know, on a constant basis, what's going on, you know, maybe give that as well. And I don't know if you can or yet or not, but the other end of the snake guy here, Chris, might want to know about, you know, what the exposure levels are like for in-ear monitoring as well. I don't know if we can go there, but love for you to touch on that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we're talking about two sides of the same coin here, because the real question is, how do we mix a show that has dynamics and has impact at a safe level, right? How do we make it feel loud and sound loud, but it's not hurting people? And so this is where you stop using just raw SPL as a substitute for a well-crafted mix that really pays attention to dynamics and stuff like that. So yeah, let's definitely touch on both sides of that. But so, I mean, Ryan, what has your, I don't want to use the word journey, and I want to make it more grandiose than it deserves, but, you know, what's your relationship been with SPL meters during your mixes? Let's start there.
I mean, it lines up with exactly what you just said. You know, first time I ever saw a speed limit, I was freaked out, genuinely afraid of it. I thought I was going to have to give up the quality of my mix in order to achieve this. And honestly, the first couple mixes I did on big things, I did. And it's because I hadn't really built the mix with SPL in mind. I just made everything sound good, right? In my opinion, good. But, you know, over time, it is exactly what you said. You can build the show so that you can take advantage of the various speed limits you may have, right? Of course, it depends, because I've done a show where somebody came up to front of house and they said, you have a 100C instantaneous limit. And there's not much I can do about that. But that was real, and they tracked it, and they were serious about it. I'm pretty sure I turned the subs off that day, and I was still hitting red here and there. But, you know, on a more typical, scenario, you'll get, I don't know, LEQ 15 minutes or something like that, or LEQ 5. So if you know you got a 15-minute window, you may want to, you know, save your big moments for spots inside of that window, and then, you know, put you know, smaller moments on either side of it. In fact, if I know that the limit we may get for any given gig is a little bit lower than we normally sit, I may even sit down with the artist and have a conversation about the set list. How can we arrange it so we've got two mellower songs and then this real big hit and then maybe another mellow song, or talking segments. Talking segments are super valuable for me in terms of bringing down the average, right? So there's a lot of manipulation there. And, you know, as you said, if you want something to sound big, you have to compare it to something smaller than it, right? Big is not just a number or a value on its own. It is a comparison. So if we want, you know, a big sounding final chorus for this big hit, then the stuff before it might have to be a little bit lower. So I have an SPL that feels like it's got good impact and comfortable to me. And I feel like every mixer has that. It's just you pull things up and this is where it feels good to you. Mine happens to be around 100A if you just measure it on a slow scale or whatever. But when I want those big moments, if I sit around that 100A, I might slowly tuck it down a little bit during maybe the last, the bridge or something. So that when I finally hit that last chorus, I actually get a bigger jump of 3 to 5 dB versus 1 dB I would get if I didn't start bringing things down before it. And I guess tool-wise, the way I do that is I keep the entire band on one fader and then vocals on a separate fader. So I can just slowly bring the band down a little bit. And then on the downbeat of the last chorus, just bump that fader 5 dB just to hit them for a moment. And you can kind of pull it back.
So I'm curious, are you intentionally, I mean, probably earlier on, you would intentionally watch what level you're affecting, and now it's more of a feel because you know what that's like? Or are you actually watching SPL when that's happening to try to keep those moments going?
I guess it kind of depends, right? So if the SPL limit we have is inside of the range where I'm like, this feels like how we normally do our show and this feels comfortable. Like, let's say the range is above that. Then I don't need to watch it at all because it's what feels right. And, you know, it can be helpful to watch it. But if that limit is right on the cusp of what feels comfortable or is below that, then I do have to watch it because what I feel as normal is going to be a little bit hotter than that. So I'm going to kind of accidentally lean into what feels normal to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of the importance of this tool as a consistency tool. Because we, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when you have the show where you're like, well, I'm kind of out of the pattern of the high frequency, so I'm gonna mix it a little bit dull on purpose so it's balanced out there. You're gonna creep back to putting that high end back just because that's what we do. So we sort of find our own level. So, you know, to push against that, you need that objective reminder, whether that's an RTA in that case or whatever that is, to keep you on track. Go ahead.
And the truth is, we lose objectivity once you're on show 6 days in a row. You know, once you just got off a flight, my ears are going to be a little bit different than they were prior to getting on that flight. High elevation, low elevation, all this stuff, we start losing objectivity. So all I really have is relative objectivity rather than like universal objectivity. Whereas the measurement tools give me this universal objectivity. So I can go, this feels louder than that, but where actually is it? That's what the tools provide for me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk about, you know, that idea of managing the dynamic range of the show and planning ahead. And I mean, if you look at some of my logs, you can literally see where I looked 2 songs down the set list and said, that's going to be the big one. And I tuck it back a dB and a half. It's not a lot, right? But that gives me somewhere to go. And a great example, my buddy Jason Moore mixes Train. And, you know, he's kind of hanging out at a reasonable level the whole show. The last song is going to be Drops of Jupiter. Everyone's losing their mind. There's confetti coming down. There's all kinds. It's crazy, right? And he's gassing it. And it's awesome. And it has a ton of impact because he's probably 4 dB louder than he has been to that point in the show. And it really, really works. But the cool thing is the reason that has impact is because he wasn't sitting there the whole show. He wasn't trying to trying to beat people up. And to kind of segue into what Kyle was talking about, that's okay to do that. If you sit there the whole night, you're probably going to hurt people. But if you go there for the last half of one song, you know, so we're looking at exposure over a period of time, and it allows you to have these loud moments and these quiet moments and to work with that dynamic. So let's talk a little bit about exposure, three prongs, right, Kyle? So you've got the audience, which is when people think about sound exposure at concerts. That's sort of the low-hanging fruit that comes to mind. You've got...
Ouch. You bought a ticket.
Poor fruit.
Yeah, poor fruit.
Well, that's the obvious one, right? But what we don't think about is the person going to the concert 4 times a year is very different than the person who's mixing 6 shows a week, right? And so if you have a level that the World Health Organization says is, you know, 4 times a year you can get to this level. Well, if the show is getting to that level, we're getting to that level every night. And so that's objectively not a great situation for us. And then the third prong, which I think is just barely starting to be talked about, which is what Kyle mentioned, the artist. And that's a situation where it's getting better. We're moving away from these just wedges that are just blasting people in the face and trying to get over the acoustic drums and the good. And so we're moving towards in-ear monitors where we can control that environment and we can give them a good experience and keep them comfortable at a much lower level. And I mean, let's start there real quick. The TM2 product from our friends at Audix is, you know, one example of this kind of new trend about, can we measure what's coming out of those in-ear monitors into that artist's ear canal? And so, yeah, you can calibrate that. I know there are a couple other products on the market that are working on a similar idea, but yeah, we're starting to pay attention to this, right? Is the key. And that's really the first step, I think, for me, is that, you know, paying attention to it, acknowledging that it's an issue. And then we talk about, what are we exposing the crew to? What are we, I mean, we were joking today about this metal show that I was mixing monitors for, and I got 14 days worth of NIOSH dose at my mix position 30 feet off the stage. Right. So what's happening on stage when they got the side fills and the drums? I mean, that's a really crazy situation. So we're starting to talk about that stuff. And then we're talking about what are we doing to the artist, or excuse me, what are we doing to the audience? And so in a way, I don't view this as two different uses. It's not like, oh, I'm just measuring for consistency or I'm just measuring for exposure. Those go hand in hand. I want to have a consistent experience that has this dynamic kind of, you know, signature to it. And it allows me to use loudness as an effective tool and get that impact, but also, you know, professionally and ethically, I can feel okay that I'm not beating people up in order to achieve that impact. And the crazy thing is, as soon as you start hurting people, you get that level, the ear does what it's designed to do, which is to try to, you know, batten down the hatches. And so now it's harder to get impact and you push it more. And so now you're just chasing your own tail on this. And so, Jamie, I know you're ready to jump in there.
Your mic's muted.
We got to unmute Jamie.
Not to embarrass myself. There we go. And I've already embarrassed myself. So just do that right out the gate, and then it can only get worse. So the thing is that when you're talking about the sound police, and also, I mean, you guys are talking about within a single act, but one of the places that this comes in handy is like, dude, I've done system engineer for a bunch of different festivals, and the thing is, it provides fairness. If it's done right, if you chose a metric that makes sense. You choose a metric that doesn't make sense, nobody cares, nobody respects it. But it, especially if you care about exposure, because then you're talking about over, you know, 8 hours of concert time, say a day. If you want to be serious about it, you want to look at exposure in a way that you don't have one act come in and just decimate your exposure. And in fact, there are places in Northern Europe where they hold them to the exposure. And so if some jerk comes in and throws down pushes the gas pedal down, they could use up all of your exposure. But the, more so, it's about fairness. Like, you know, when people want to, they don't want somebody else mixing at an extremely high level before you, where you're trying to behave. And so you can set it up so the policing, you can be their friend, that you're just refereeing to keep everybody has to play by the same rules. One of the places that we met Michael was playing EQ referee for speaker shootouts. And that was, that was his own brand of madness. But that's the thing, is that if people believe it's at least giving objective fairness to it, they're willing to behave by it. If they just believe that somebody's making some arbitrary, stupid SPL limit, the town committee won't let you go above 100 C instantaneous or whatever, people won't respect it. But the times I've been involved with it, people will embrace it if everybody gets treated fairly.
And I think, you know, that's been a kind of an eye opener for me working on this stuff. I spent most of 2019 just going to shows and logging the shows and talking to the engineers and saying, you know, what do you want this thing to do? What do you look at? I want to know what metrics you're looking at when you mix. I want to know, you know, what role this plays. And so just getting all that feedback from how people use these tools and how they would wish to use the tools if they, you know, were designed differently or what features they would want and stuff like that. And so one of the things that is a big challenge is this understanding the metrics, where, you know, that church in Bixby that was on the news, right? You have a limit at the property line that's A-weighted. Oh. So it ignores all the sub-energy. It's the sub-energy that's going to bother your neighbors, and they're getting noise complaints. And so you have a situation where they are not breaking the law. They're completely compliant, but you're getting noise complaints. So the purpose of the law is not to get noise complaints, to be respectful to the neighbors. So you're talking about, you know, this is rooted in a situation where we don't understand the metrics well enough to apply these tools, you know, in a reasonable way, Ryan.
You know, the danger with that is that if you've got a bad metric there for the measurement and then you continue to piss off the neighbors, they're just going to put an even worse metric in for the measurement. until they learn it, right? So at that point, let's say it's supposed to be 70A at the property line. Now it's going to be 60A at the property line, and every bicyclist that goes by is going to make it go off, right? So it becomes unusable. So teaching people about what the metrics really mean is so valuable.
Thanks, Space Nectar.
Well, that's what? Been, what? You know, and Rock it's Riddance. Funny because when we get into, we do classes, workshops where we work directly with front of house engineers on how to understand these tools, how to use these tools, how do you make a mix that sounds big and impactful and dynamic and you know how to mix around the meter basically, right? But you have to spend the first 15 minutes of each of these classes laying out the terms. Let's talk about what's fast and slow and what do they mean. Let's talk about the weighting curves. What's the difference between the integration and the LEQ? We need that common vocabulary because when you say something like keep it under 95, which is something that I've been told by a, you know, I go that, you know, Pooch said it really well. He said that's not a complete sentence from a technical perspective, right? So the first step here, and I think largely where we are still, at least here in the United States, is getting the vocabulary laid out so we can all talk on an equal footing. We can all be talking about the same thing.
Well, the unfortunate thing is, too, that fast and slow are really the only flavors that have been served to us for the longest time. Vanilla and chocolate, right? There's other flavors. And the thing is that's useless to the stuff we're talking about, fast and slow. It's good for, yell and see how loud you can yell, see how loud you can get the crowd to yell. That's what it's good for. But it's not good for looking at any of these things. But how many handheld meters of the cheap meters that people have? They don't have LEQ. People don't know LEQ. And I got to say, the first place I ran into this was actually in Berkeley when we were living, working for Meyer up at the Bowl there. And when Primus came through in the Bowl, that was the first place I saw them using LEQ as the noise limit, because I guess some professors knew what they were doing or something like that. But I watched Derek Featherstone ultrasound, but he was mixing Primus up there, and he happened to know the sound police person kind of intimately. But it was weird to see Primus like take breaks in between songs and dial things back. So they were really playing that game already. That was the first time I had seen that. But it was then 10 years before I saw that in another place. It was just, I didn't see it here in the US anyways, or at festivals.
Well, that's a big part of it is, you know, understanding, first of all, that the rule makes sense, right? And that it accomplishes what it's supposed to accomplish, but also how I'm going to mix around a 15-minute A-weighted limit is way different than how I'm going to mix around a, you know, a C slow. So we can play the game, so to speak. The better you understand the metric, how it's measured, what affects it, and what you can do to get around it, you know, you're stacking the deck in your favor here. And you can, you know, there are ways to create impact when you're against a C-weighted limit. There are ways to create impact when you're up against A-weighted limit. So a better understanding of these metrics that's only going to give you a better tool set to kind of achieve what you're trying to achieve. Jamie's laughing at something.
I'm thinking of that shootout where they were being held. We did C, we did A, but basically there was one person there that kept pushing we were doing C weighted, and there was somebody that was pushing their low frequency. They were kept re-EQing it. And so the low frequency was counting. And so they were wondering why they sounded quieter, and they were eating up all their SPL base. And it was just really funny. You could never get the fact that because the way he EQ'd his system, he was going to sound quieter when, you know, demoing the speakers to the people in there. That it was just really funny that there was somebody who really didn't understand the metrics.
Right. And he had his subs that went down to like 22 hertz. So, you know, you're filling out a whole octave of spectrum that's being integrated into that reading that the other systems in the room aren't. So you're penalizing yourself. So it's a perfect example of understand how it's being metered. So you can kind of shape within that. Ryan?
You know, it's pretty common that, you know, someone will come and say, yeah, 95, stay under that, right? I don't think that's an unheard of thing. I think anyone who's ever mixed a show has seen someone come up with that, right? Where it becomes a real problem, though, is when a mixer becomes defensive about it, right? There's two ways to approach that, right? Someone says, you know, you got to hit 95. You can go, well, that's bullshit. It doesn't mean anything. I don't know what you're saying. F you. I'm going to go do what I want. Or you can actually work together to figure out what their actual goal is and what you're doing, right? So I've been on both sides of that. I've been in a scenario certainly where I was like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about. And then at the end of the day, it just ends up being a pain in the butt for both of us, right? And then, you know, more recently, I'll say it's probably because my mixes have gotten better. Because of this, I don't have as much of a trouble with hitting some of these numbers. But now someone comes at me and says, this is the number you need to hit, and the number is not actually well-defined, I'll have a full conversation with them of, well, what are we trying to do? Okay, well, you don't want to make it too loud. Okay, but who is that for? Who are you not trying to make it too loud for? Okay, well, it's a city ordinance. Okay, well, is the problem that those neighbors over there are having a problem? Or is it a problem that these people over here are having a problem? And once we figure that out, not only have we figured out a better metric for me to follow, but also I've actually created a pretty good relationship with a guy who's ready to be at battle with me. And by kind of just embracing the idea that we have to work together today, it usually turns into, we have a short conversation, he or she watches three songs and then goes, cool, I'm out of here. And it's not that he leaves and then I go, now I can turn up the gas, but it's more just like, even if it didn't match the numbers, there's an understanding of where we should be hitting and we're both on the same page, you know?
Yeah, I'm curious to see when in the U.S., right now I feel like in the U.S. at least, most of the time that there's a speed limit, it's because of noise ordinances and nuisance, as opposed to the U.S. actually caring about people and the people in the venue, not necessarily people outside of the venue. And I'm curious on when that's going to flip. Shocking. I mean, obviously, the Europe has the lead on this.
When Live Nation gets sued, then they'll care. For hearing damage. Somebody will go to a show wearing a dosimeter, sit next to the stacks, document that they were driven to 4,000% exposure. And then when that happens, everybody will get serious about it that way. That's got to be why Apple is putting dosimeters in their Apple Watch, is because they know they've been sticking earbuds into the kids' heads for years, and now they need to go, but wait, we want a SPL in moderation, kids. So I mean that's the cynical side of it, but that's the reality.
It's the reality.
And you know, and I'll also
I think it's going to change. I'm very curious, how do festivals, I guess open air, they probably don't read it as much, but like how are indoor festivals and concerts actually going to be able to survive at the levels people are currently used to when we actually institute OSHA or more importantly, NIOSH rules on a concert? They're not going to be the same. They're going to have to take longer.
I don't know. I think that I've been to a few festivals in recent times that held to some pretty, I mean, like, you know, 100 A-weight LEQ 10 or 15 or something like that. And they, you didn't even notice that you were being limited at all. You can, if people learn what you guys were talking about before that, learning for people to mix within that pocket. We used to do opera in the park, and it's out there on the Great Lawn, and you have all these delays out there, and people come in and they sit down and they listen to opera. And what was really funny was that when it got really quiet, like there's barely stuff coming out of the system, the whole crowd noise level would go down and people would moderate themselves. And then when it got louder, people would talk louder and louder. And there was this whole everything chasing itself. I think that after seeing what you guys have talked about mixers wise, about being able to work effectively in that range, I think that once the level's established and the people discuss what they need to do to work within it, I think it's gonna be fine. People just need another set of skills.
Yeah, I think it's largely about understanding the tool and again how to work with it. But I mean, I'll also say, you know, there are, you know, inappropriately low limits where you're like, well, the drummer has to go outside if that's, you know, he has to leave if we're going to do that. And I'm not talking about that because, again, that stems from an understanding of what the metrics actually mean and what the realistic, you know, situation is. But when you have a realistic limit, you know, it's not as big of a challenge to kind of deal with it as you might think, as long as, like Ryan said, you start with the understanding that, you know, I mean, one of the things I did during quarantine was my said, I'm going to get the band that I mix, I'm going to get their cruising speed SPL down by 3 dB. Half the exposure. It's a good goal, right? I'm going to just lower it. I pulled up some logs and I said, okay, you know, they usually sit at 92, 93 A live when we're talking about small venues locally, right? And so I'm going to get that down to 87, 88. And approaching the whole mix with that in mind. And what's funny is you go, okay, I'm going to get my multi-tracks out. I'm going to start putting a mix together. The first thing you bring up, that kick drum or the vocal or whatever, out of habit, you crank it till you're sitting at 91A. And you already just backed yourself into that corner that now I have to be at this level. Start, build a board mix and try it. Start at 82A and see what you do. And the decisions that you make, how you sculpt the low end of your mix is huge, right? Kyle, I know you got comments on that.
Yeah. Well, I think Ryan and I, we've been to Europe a ton of times, and they've taken control of this, and also Canada as well. So, we've all experienced the thing where we're like, oh man, how are we going to deal with this today? And it's the explanation of the metrics that make a difference. Like Ryan said, are we worried about annoying people next door that are trying to sleep? Are we trying to help the people in the venue retain their hearing for some kind of medical reason? And some of those venues, now that I've been back to them several times, have adjusted their metrics to that. They've added delays inside. They've put metering in reasonable spots in the venue instead of 20 feet away from the PA. So we always had that challenge. And if you take it as a challenge, the problem isn't the problem. The problem is your attitude towards the problem. And you need to take that as it is. And it is a challenge. I'm from the old school, let's mix with a vengeance. It really is. You know, I used to ask the sound police, hey, what are we going to do with the crowd when they hit 110? You know, are you going to penalize me because the kids want to sing along? So now I think the people that are doing this are recognizing the metric of the crowd itself, people singing along, taking averages and doing longer. It used to be immediate. You know, you'd get the red light at front of house that you were hitting your thing. And if that red light stayed on for more than a certain amount of time, it would shut.
Automatically shut off. I remember that.
It's a thing. So yeah. I think if we as the community of audio folks help set those metrics for the people that don't understand, Mr. Officer, we won't have to explain it to the judge or pay the fine if we help them set that metric. And I think that's super interesting. It's easier now than it used to be. And I think people are starting to realize that, but they're, and like Jamie said, people take advantage of it, and one person can penalize a whole group of people coming into that venue next time. And that's why I made the bass nectar joke. It's in poor taste. If you watch the podcast, you know I'm poor taste anyway. So,
well, Kyle, I mean, I think, you know, there's you hit on a couple really important ideas there, right? So the first is this idea that, you know, let's have a dialogue with the people who are coming up with these rules. And in the US, it's a patchwork, right? So, you know, one of the things I'm involved with an AES technical committee that is working with World Health Organization, who is working on basically a proposed standard for recreational noise, concert sound, stuff like that. So we're trying to make sure that what they come up with is based in reality and is practical and is, you know, something that is appropriate for a concert mixer to hit. So like not using sometimes the LEQ, they'll say it's, you know, it's the length of the show. Well, you know, if the opening act already ate into that limit, then you might get to the point where the headline has to turn the PA off and still can't comply. Right. So we're just trying to bring the knowledge of how events happen logistically and to, okay, let's go with a 15-minute limit for the same number, because it's still going to give you that exposure protection, but it's achievable for a mix engineer. So that's one thing, is coming back to education, coming back to understanding. The other thing I think is context. So, you know, great point, Kyle, about, well, hey, what if the crowd sets it off? Do I have to pay the fine, right? So there's a mismatch here, because you have legal situations where people are fined and taken to court, but they're being measured with a $19 plastic meter that's older than I am, right?
Isn't very old, by the way, but oh, I'm just kidding.
Well, come on now. So, you know, part of it is, understanding the metrics. If you're going, I have to choose A or C, and I have to choose fast or slow, okay, you got to make a choice. Well, with a modern tool, you don't have to make that choice. I'm looking at probably 5 or 6 metrics in front of me when I'm mixing. So I know what my A and C levels are over the last minute and the last 10 seconds and the last 15 minutes. And I know what the C minus A is. So part of that is, yeah, we can tell if it was crowd noise or PA noise, because I was looking at the 60 gigahertz octave band and there was no energy there. So my subs weren't playing, right? That's people. So as our technology has expanded, and a lot of stuff we're doing in Smart is to give mixers these tools to answer these questions and to give themselves that context, our understanding of the metrics and how they react to different things that are happening in the show has improved as well. And that allows us to be more informed. And I think a lot of times the rule, you know, understanding what the rule actually is. I mean, Ryan, having that conversation, it's a funny story, and I think I tell it in every class, but the house manager of the venue came out and said, hey, keep it under 95. He kind of just left. I said, no, come on back. Let's have a chat. Right. And so, you know, I put up like 8 meters. I said, which one of these am I supposed to keep under 95? And so he went like, what it ended up being is that the rule was, when the clock on the wall in the concession stand starts vibrating, it's too loud. And that's what they use as their metric. So again, let's start on common ground. Let's understand what you consider to be too loud and why, and go from there. So I think education on all sides. And I know, Ryan, go ahead. I know you got comments on that.
Well, there's a couple things there. I mean, one of the things about taking on ownership of your own SPL is that it makes everyone else feel more comfortable, right? Because I'm going, no, I'm going to own this. I'll take care of this. You don't actually need to police me. And I'll put it in a place where you can see it the entire day. And if you want to come over and you look at it and it looks like a number you're not comfortable with, you know, we can have a conversation. But the fact that I've even put it there and made it visible is taking ownership of this problem that an SPL police guy often finds to be a battle, right? I'm taking away the battle completely, right? Yeah. And then also to go with what Kyle mentioned, you know, I imagine many of you have also gone through this for long enough in time that, you know, 10 years ago or so, it was just, no, SPL limits on everything. Here's one there. And it was a battle back then, because people didn't understand what they were limiting. They just wanted to limit it. And it was really hard to have the conversation. Now we're in this spot where every front of house engineer has a laptop anyways. You're probably using it for 10 other things. You may as well put up your SPL there. The tools are there. It's so easy for us to, you know, calibrate our system and do this, that, you know, the limits themselves have developed over time. We're evolving. We're kind of in this point now where more people are willing to be more accurate with limits. Back then, 10 years ago, they were just 95. That's it, period. Whatever else you say, I don't care. And it was hard for me 10 years ago to have a tool that could accurately measure this and show it to them, and we could be on the same plane. Today, it's so easy for me to have that tool. It's so easy for us to be transparent. And subsequently, we can help those limits be more useful, more accurate.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why Michael didn't just go tighten the clock down at the concession stand.
Well, you know what? That's funny. I mean, Kyle, no, that's it. It's funny, but the point is legitimate, right? Because there's a reason that they're seeking to limit it. And so that's legitimate. It's very legitimate to say that we don't want to hurt people, right? If you disagree with that, you probably shouldn't be in charge of operating a system that is capable of hurting people, right? No different than rigging electricity. It's very legitimate to say we want to be respectful of our neighbors. It's very legitimate to say the people that we employ, we don't want to put them at risk of damage, right? So So the motives behind this are very important and very sincere. So I think we have to keep that in mind. We're just trying to clear up the specifications of that. And can we agree on a way that makes sense for us to do that? That's really what a lot of these things come down to. This whole idea of it, you know, if it's too loud, you're too old, like that's thankfully pretty much starting to die off. And, you know, I have to say, after talking to a lot of engineers about this, by and large, they are, as a group, absolutely concerned about not hurting people and, you know, not getting the venue in trouble and not getting fined. I mean, these are legitimate, serious professional concerns. I think we're just talking about clarifying how are we accomplishing these things.
I think it's a matter of education all the way around, is that oftentimes when somebody was holding me to a limit 20 years ago, they didn't understand their equipment. They didn't understand the measurement. And if I had an analyzer or something that was measuring it, they'd always defer to me. I mean, I've never had anybody challenge my meter or know more about my meter, even if it was a simple meter. But when I first started doing this stuff, I remember Don Pearson teaching me to, you could use hairspray on the microphone that was doing the SPL so that buy you more SPL, because they don't know anything about their measurement.
Yep. Or your gum.
Yeah. And so the whole thing is just that both sides are getting more educated to what they're going, and they have real valid desires for setting limits and things like that. So it's, the conversation is just improved all the way around when people know what they're talking about here, about with all these things, because there's nothing worse than somebody enforcing an arbitrary, you know, BS random number.
And yeah. I think it's always good to tie in, you know, whoever the TM or the PM is, you know, make them aware, because some of this stuff we shouldn't have to deal with. And then on the other side of that, we also probably have dealt with some artists that are like, screw it, pay the fine. But at the end of the day, that comes back on you. So those are two things that should be addressed well, you know, like, maybe I shouldn't jump in this because I don't want to be the bad guy later on when the TM's standing in front of house with me and things are getting weird, you know. Do it for yourself, one, you know, keep yourself out in line, make sure that everyone's good. And I think maybe at the beginning of tours, whoever the headliner is, the TM should probably address all the opening acts and make sure that this is a part of the advance as well, as to make sure, hey, this is where we're going to start. This is what we're going to do. And if, like I said, if we take control of this and someone else isn't coming to us with an arbitrary number or a shitty realistic SPL meter, we'll end up winning at the end of the day. And when we come back into that venue, they'll be like, oh, these guys are going to be cool. Awesome.
One of the things when you're saying taking control of it, that's why I held up my cell phone, is that one of the cool things we did put into the SPL program was the ability to share the meters over a browser, so that you could have somebody monitoring other places. So I think it was Ryan who was saying, we'll allow you to see the meter. We're not trying to hide this from you. We can share this. It's open. You can see what the numbers are. If we don't agree on the numbers, we'll come back and talk. But yeah, that's something that is being enabled. I think that's a really cool thing.
Yeah, go back to catering. Hang out there. Chill out. It'll be fine.
Yep.
Yeah, I think in terms of education, I think for our own education, one of the things that I learned early on, or was most apparent to me, was using timeline or the SPL history timeline and watching that during a show. It's very hard for our brains to correlate watching numbers bounce, especially fast and slow. At least LEQ, you can at least see it over time. But so, and I'll actually share one of my views of mixing from a show. And there's two purposes to this. There we go. Cool. So this is two identical services within a church service, right? So, and the top and bottom, first service, second service. So I can do a couple things here. Watch. I can consistently through the show, I can watch and see where I'm riding. I can see where I can build momentum. And it goes back to like Ryan's thing. Like, it's not just watching numbers. I can literally watch it over time. I can watch LEQ over time. And then I can compare hey, am I giving the same experience night after night, or service after service? And you can see how consistent you are and set your metrics there. So for me, the visual side of the history was mind-blowing in terms of, and then it goes back to kind of why I asked Ryan this, like once you can correlate that mentally, then you can, it can become just muscle memory to know what that feels like, as opposed to just having to constantly watch a screen.
Definitely. And you know, it's funny because at a certain point in time, you know, in the career of mixing, you go, this feels right to me. Anything less than that feels wrong, right? But the way you build your mix kind of affects what it sounds like, right? And so if I build a mix at a really low volume, it'll sound really good at a really low volume. Then when I play it really loud, it might kind of come apart, right? The low mids might be too much. And once we start, you know, coupling it across all these boxes and start pushing it out at this volume, it just doesn't work the same way. If I build my mix at a really high volume, it'll sound great at a high volume. When I start turning it down, it tends to be really light on the low mids, and it's very different. So if your goal ultimately is to bring the SPL of your whole show down a little bit, we're all really fortunate right now that virtual sound check is so easy on almost every tool there is. And we've got all sorts of dynamic EQs and all sorts of crazily powerful tools to get in control. So if you want to build a quieter show, use your virtual sound check and start tweaking what you have at a lower level. You will end up with a show that you feel better at that lower level, rather than just taking your loud show that you've already built and turning it down. It's not going to work in the same way.
Right. And that's so important, Ryan. And that's kind of where we can't ignore, from the mix engineer side of things, you know, human perception, how that works. What does loud mean to us? You know, we know that adding upper harmonic distortion makes it sound louder. We know that adding more sub energy makes it sound louder, right? So understanding that, and when you go, you know, you get to, and it's a very, very relatable idea, and we're all guilty of this. Okay, that's almost there. I'm just going to turn it up a little more until I'm happy with it. Instead of turning it up more, change the mix until you're happy with it. Like, what is it about that, you know, that you're seeking, and go after that in the mix? And so that's, I mean, I have shows cruising at 85, 86A, you know, over a couple of minutes. And when it peaks up a little bit above that, your ear's like, oh, wow, I'm going to pull it back. Like, you really quickly adjust to the normal of what that is. And, you know, I don't want to go too far down this hole, but we talked about it at NAMM this year and Vent Safety Summit this year. And this idea that we have conditioned audiences to expect show to be uncomfortably loud. People show up to concerts with earplugs. Why do they do that? Because they are conditioned to be prepared to be exposed to uncomfortably high SPL. And what I found is running my shows at these lower levels, I mean, I had the box office person saying, this is probably the first show we've had in this venue where someone didn't come out and complain and ask for a refund, right? Which is telling. People seem to be pleasantly surprised that they can just sit there and enjoy the show and not get steamrolled. So, and again, I go there, but I don't sit there for 4 hours, right? So, learning more about how we perceive sound and loudness and what plays into that and where we can cheat is a huge part of this as well. Kyle, no, turns out.
Oh, go ahead, Kyle.
Well, I wanted to remind everybody who's watching us right now, if you guys have any questions, let's jump in, because we're kind of running up against the clock now too. And I want to totally thank Ryan and Jamie for coming, because this is one of the coolest SPL conversations that we've had, just kind of off the cuff. We'll have to do this again. So check out the podcast, signaltonoise.podcast.com. We'll do this again, because I think
Hey, Mick, what's up, sir?
Holy cow.
Oh, wait, I think your mic is muted.
You muted.
We got...
he has to unmute. Mick, you may unmute yourself. I can't do it for you, unfortunately.
I can't do it either.
He's got it. That looks right.
I should tell a story. I haven't seen Mick since, holy cow, it's been a while.
Oh, unmute. Man. That sucks. It says it looks like it says it's unmuted.
Yeah, it says it's unmuted, but we still can't hear you. The beard factor just tripled, basically. Though this is great. There, oh look, we have now.
There you go.
we'll just pretend.
I'll tell a story. So I'm this crappy kid from St. Louis, and I was going to try out this desk, and I got invited over to this dude's house in Birmingham somewhere, and I walk in, and it's Mick, and there's an XL8 in his living room, and I get the mix on it, and I sat there and rewound battery over and over and over, and I mixed that song probably 20 times while these dudes were off in the kitchen drinking coffees, and man, I had a blast, dude. I had so much fun that day. That's my mix story.
I remember you telling that story, Kyle. Mick, I don't know if you got your mic working yet, but you got to reach out to us. We got to get you on the show, man. Yeah, great to chat with you. Yeah. Sure.
Let's find a sound engineer.
Yeah. I see Jay and Bob Cowan more than I see Mick. Mick's like this elusive dude. Now he's just going to pop in. I can't hear him. This is a tease.
I got to tell you that I don't like this interface where mute is it's filled in for the video, and it's a bad interface.
We
didn't pick the interface, just saying.
just to throw in one thing before any of us, Ryan, have to run. You know, if I go back historically enough in terms of like mixing shows or whatever, I know that I used to judge how loud a show was by whether the horns on the PA were starting to distort. And that was how I go, this feels intense. You get that tiny bit of horn distortion.
No, it's when the light bulbs inside the speaker start glowing. That's how you know when.
No. The speakers start glowing, the whole thing. But there was this thing where you kind of had just learned that this little bit of like horn distortion had this feeling of intensity, right? And I try to recreate that in mixes now too. There are certain elements in a mix where I will on purpose add saturation to give it that feeling of intensity that is kind of how I used to feel when I'd hear speakers start to distort. And, you know, I might do with transient stuff like, I don't know, a snare. If I wanted to really feel intense, add that tiny bit of saturation and it kind of emulates horn distortion. Or same with like a bass. You can even do it on low frequency stuff. Make it feel like the speaker is distorting. And at that point, you don't have to make it loud.
I got a great story about this. I've said this multiple times on the podcast. But so I was on a, you know, R&B hip hop style tour. And they, you know, they wanted it super loud. Like we're flying 4-6 boxes of Vertec 4-89 side fills. They just want it crushing loud. And we figured out that it's like, you know what, they're used, a lot of people are used to hearing a breaking point, a distortion point when they think it's loud enough. And so they want to get to that point. And so we started throwing distortion on the mix for people to think that it was louder than it was so that it didn't have to get as loud. That, for sure, I've done that plenty of times.
So I'll just add one thing. Yep. So I noticed it in metal bands and the click of the kick drum. In compression drivers, that was your distortion point, because I had to work on a SLS rig that had ribbon drivers, and I was trying to get that clickety tickety tack type sound, and I couldn't get it.
Yeah. You have to put it in.
I was like, why is that? And there was this old guy, he was Pete at A1 Audio in Branson, Missouri, told me, was like, dude, you're trying to get the compression driver to distort. That's distortion. That's not the sound of the kick drum.
So can we hear you now, Mick?
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Victory!
Yes. Hi, guys.
Awesome.
I'm going to turn around. Hang on a minute. Let me get the other way up. There you go. That's better. How you doing, guys? Good?
Amazing. Yeah.
Excellent. Better now that you're here.
Yeah.
I've been listening to you for a while, actually. It's been very interesting. Yeah. It's noise, police, and all the rest of it. I agree with most you've said, to be honest with you. I really enjoy having the 10 Easy display on my end bay on my XL8 all the time.
Yes.
I have kind of put the 10 Easy and the Smart together on one screen so I can actually see the dynamics of it and see the dynamics of the volume as well. And I display it for the whole show, and I must admit, I spend most of the time staring at that because I kind of find it really fascinating. And I have actively, over probably the last few years, as you've all said, been actively working to be quieter. You know, I think we all kind of got a bit carried away. The system's got infinitely more powerful over time, but we fail to acknowledge that. You know, when we used to be using Martin bins and all the older systems, you could never get to the SPLs. They could be flat out and still only do half what one of these new line arrays will do with 80 subs aside, you know? So I think there was we all got sucked in a little bit to the fader's always at 0 dB on the LNR, and that's where you started and that's where you went from. And I think we've all sort of, and we never had the measuring tools for the years and years. And now we can actually see how loud we are. I think it's very useful, you know. I am about 100 dB. I aim for about 100, 99, 100, somewhere there. Bigger bits, 103, you know. And I used to run on average for an outdoor festival at front of house. I'd be looking at probably 103 to 106 for many years. So this is a departure of probably 3 dB from what I would normally do. There is a little opposition to it from some punters. They want it more, you know, they want it louder. But yeah, it's such a tough one. And, you know, when you've got so many different zones going on, you better have good system guys who are going to go out and give you this nice even coverage across the whole venue.
Yes.
And then, of course, how far's front of house? What are you measuring? The German system I found to be the best. They configure a microphone at 1 meter from the nearest box to the audience, and that gives you your base reference for the volume of the system. And then all the other mics around the venue, of course, if you've got a loud crowd, it could make it look like you've rooked it up 3 dB just because they're all singing along. But, of course, the bass mic, the reference mic 1 meter in front of the PA always proves that you've never turned it up and that it is actually audience noise. That is a smart way to do it. That's the Germans. Unfortunately, you know, as you go around the place, normally you end up with a guy standing next to you at front of house measuring exactly the same thing you are. So, yeah, there's a lot to be learned to measure the volume of concerts. It is not just one at front of house. Even when the noise police are around with their B&K sitting there roaring away with a guy who doesn't even know what it's set to. I mean, I've caught about so many times, you know, guys, there's a guy there with a yellow jacket on and you get talking to him, you find out he's just a stagehand who's been told to stand by this meter and look like he's the sound police. And you suss him straight away just by going, what are you measuring? Is it C-weighted or I don't know, mate, you know. You always catch him out. It's kind of funny, actually.
But you can tell because he's got the rested against his chest. So
he doesn't care when it rains and the mic's out in the rain and he's still standing on the riser and the thing's dripping in the rain and you're like, yeah, you're not really a sound guy, are you? You know.
We used to buy him shots. We used to try to buy the sound police shots. Like, hey, man. It's late. It's after 5.
So, Mick, have you ever had to have a conversation with Metallica and say, hey, today we're at this limit. Can we maybe rearrange things or do things differently? Are they understanding of that?
No, they'd never fucking change what they do.
It's worth asking.
They do what they do. I do what I do, and they do what they do, and never the twain shall meet. No, I mean, what are we talking about, really? It's like, you know, we go to Switzerland, it's 100 dB. I don't care who the fuck you are, it's 100 dB. And, you know, it used to be a pain in the ass because when I was at my higher SPLs and I'd go into Switzerland, it's like, shit, got to completely restructure this. And, of course, you know, we've all done the wrong thing. You grab the left and right and you turn that down and you try to do it on the left and right, which never works. You have to restructure the mix that goes to the LNR because you start bottling the power you got for your vocal. And then all of a sudden, you're pushing the vocal VCA, and you're like, whoa, that's higher than I've ever pushed that bit. What's going on here? And then you suddenly think, yeah, but I'm 5 or 6 dB down on the LNR because I'm trying to rein in the whole fucking mix. And the reality of it is, you should have just backed everything off. You know, I have a Grandmaster VCA, which actually controls every channel but the vocal channels. So I set the band volume with that Master VCA. and then all the other VCAs work within that. So I can pick the volume of the band against the volume of the vocal. So, and then, of course, you know, you scurry it around a little bit, don't you? You know, and a lot of the times, overall SPL, I think, of systems is dependent on the system EQ. It depends on how full. You were talking about it earlier. You know, a lot of time you'll reach for more volume because you want something to sound bigger. You want that kick drum to sound bigger. You need that fatter snare. You know, you want that floor tom to move soil. So you start reaching for the pressure knobs instead of actually going, well, I won't go for the volume. I'll just tailor the EQ a little. The problem comes, I think, is when you get systems that have an inherent problem, whether it's with the design, a tuning issue, phasing issue. You know, you've flown subs that are anti-phase to your ground subs or partially so, and you're not. It's not delivering the punch that you're looking for. So the first fix is you look to do it with a bit more volume. You know, you want that kick drum to thump a bit more. No, I'll just chock it up a little bit. And we've all had the experience of doing the mix when you think, this overall mix just doesn't seem to be coming together, and you crack the left and right like one literally fucking half a millimeter or so, and all of a sudden the mix seems to come together infinitely better just for a slight volume increase, whether it be a humidity thing or whatever is the core problem. But we've all done that and gone, whoa, that's made such a difference, that little turn up there. It's a tough call. It's normally down to a poor system tuning, I think, when you start reaching deep for extra volume. But I do like the way it's going. And I think now with the 10 Easy particularly, which is by far the easiest system by far and believed by many, you know, it's like you have a sound police guy come up on the riser and he sees that you've got a 10 Easy and it's running and you're paying attention to it. They get a certain comfort to them. They feel more comfortable out of the day. They're not seeing conflict, you know, that you're going to have to tell them to fuck off at some point. I have done that, I'll be honest. I did threaten to break one's fingers once because he went to reach for the L&R on the desk. And I grabbed his fingers and I'm like, one of us is going to lie on the floor in a moment and it's not going to be me. The guy got the message and says, I'm going to fetch the police. So I says, all right, you go and fetch the police. And while he was fetching the police, I finished the show anyway and fucked off. So who cares, eh? You know? And I think that was either Castle Donington Festival or it was it Castle Donington or Milton Keynes Bowl, one of those big festival gaffes. Yeah, it was. He got really angry with me because I got the mix to the volume he liked, but then I turned up guitar solos, and then he got really angry with me because I kept destroying his SPL. And I'm like, I have to mix the show as well, you know? I can't just get it to what you fucking want. But I've had a few rucks with them. But I have not had so many rucks with them since I show that I watch the SPL. They are much more accommodating, you know, and I've always been allowed a little bit more. I think, you know, these noise measurers, they always tend to give me a few more dB with the last band on normally, and all gloves are off. They want to watch the show more often than not. And so, I let them get on with it. Somebody else can speak. Sorry.
It definitely helps when your SPL police actually like your artist. They let you get away with so much more.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I need the beard. I think that's what I've been missing this whole time. That's why you're getting away with this.
Actually, I need a bit of a trim. I haven't done my mustache or anything. I mean, even my eyebrows are fucking raw. This is lockdown hair growth. Horns on.
COVID horns.
Oh, Chris, are we up against our end of our session here? I don't know what the
rule technically is. We're kind of up against it. So yeah, let's kind of put a
ball. Well, Mick, let's get in touch. We got to get you on the show, man, and dig into this conversation more. We definitely want to also thank Mick. We want to thank Ryan and Jamie for joining us and for sharing their thoughts on this topic. And we thank everybody for tuning in. If you have questions, comments on what we talked about today, you can visit us at signalnoisepodcast.com and drop us a line. Thanks, everybody.
See you guys.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeet.